The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
To really grow and attract new members. In 1928, there were 24,000 members of this party, but due to this shift, by 1932, it had fallen to about 6,000, some say 5,000 members. So after Stalin, this is what was going on there, after Stalin expelled Trotsky from the Communist Party, supporters of Trotsky were kicked out of Communist parties all over the world. And those who were kicked out or left started a lot of their own organizations. One of these was the Communist League of America, or CLA, which was led by James P. Cannon and others that you'll hear about. The membership of these young socialist organizations looked to the labor movement as a vital base for radicalization and the struggle against capital. Many of the members of these organizations were working within the labor movement and key industries like transportation, building trades, and manufacturing. In the CLA branch in Minneapolis, the leaders were Carl Skoglin and three of the Dune brothers, Ray, Grant, and Miles. Apparently there were a lot of other Dune brothers, so I don't know how many, there were 12 of them or something, I don't know. But anyway, Ray, Grant, and Miles are the ones we care about. And Dobbs was recruited by Skoglin, and then he went on to play an important role in the CLA as well as in the labor movement. Now on the other side, the bosses had their own group, they had their own organization called the Citizens Alliance. The alliance was made up of major business owners who pretty much ruled over everyone else and kept the smaller players in line. The alliance was closely aligned with the Minneapolis Police Department, who then as today basically did their bidding. When they needed to help busting heads, the police had a practice of deputizing members of the alliance and their supporters, and these deputies played a very violent role in the 1934 strike. Another player in all this, and I hope we'll get into this more in the discussion, but another player in this was the governor of Minnesota, Floyd Olson. Olson was actually a member of the Farm Labor Party, which was a populist party born in Minnesota in 1918 that tried to forge the interests of laborers and farmers. Indeed, members of the party were supported some very progressive reforms, but they talked a lot left as they got into power and they changed a little bit. At the beginning of the strike, Olson actually even sent money to the strike funds and said, "I'm not a liberal, I'm a radical." So, but in a not too all familiar move, as we've seen today, when push came to shove, the governor showed his true colors, calling out the National Guard to act basically as a strike-breaking force, but I'm getting ahead of myself. One thing though, because of his progressive rhetoric, Olson was vulnerable to pressure both from below and that really made a difference. I have to note that one other thing about the Farm Labor Party in Minnesota, and we can talk a little bit more about that, but they started out as rivals to the Democratic Party, but as time went on, they actually ended up merging with the Democratic Party in 1944. And actually to this day, the Democratic Party in Minnesota is called the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. So that alone should tell you a little bit about this party's role, at least later, in bringing progressives back into the Democratic fold. So here we go. The Minneapolis CLA branch decided that it was time to build an industrial campaign to unionize workers, and they felt that the coal trucking industry was a fertile ground. Some were already working the coal yards like Skoglin and Dobbs, and there were opportunities to talk to people and to convince them about joining the union. Local 574, as I said, was a generalist union, so it was easier to take a broader viewpoint on union membership. They were less restricted, and they felt they could reach out not only to drivers and loaders, but to other people who worked inside the plants, in shipping and receiving and stocking. So, and the conditions were ripe. The coal industry was one of the worst. When he started in 1933 in the coal industry, Farrell Dobbs worked 60 hours a week as a coal heaver, making roughly $18 a week, or about 30 cents an hour. Overtime was non-existent, and with thousands out of work, the bosses were very sure to make you well aware that you could be replaced at a moment's notice. So Dobbs, along with Skoglin and the Dunes and others, began to organize and grow the union. One thing they had to do early on was isolate some of the more conservative members of their executive board. So what they did was they created an organizing committee that was able to sort of bypass the executive board to get things done. So now I'll get into what really happened. Members of this organizing committee crisscrossed the city, talking to workers about the union and identifying issues and concerns that could later be used to form demands. So the first action of this was organized in 1934. There's a story in the book, I won't get into it much here, but Ray Dunn basically duped his boss into allowing him to set up an employee-only beer bash party to boost morale, and that is actually where they got together and took a look at what the demands they wanted to issue, what they wanted to do. So I thought that was kind of cool. So the local 574 members, with leadership and help from Skoglund and the other radicals, started right off the bat by issuing this set of clear demands. They had really thought it through, and they'd really prepared well and strategically. Basically, it's the dead of winter in Minneapolis, and what better time to hold up the coal? So when the bosses, you know, just kind of laughed it off and immediately rejected the demands, the union responded by shutting down 65 of the city's 67 coal yards. The bosses were pretty much caught by surprise. They were not prepared, and they actually conceded some of the demands right away. So I thought that was cool. Bolstered by the win, Local 574 then grew in leaps and bounds. Like I said, in 33, when Dobbs started, there were 75 members. In April of 34, they had grown to 30,000 members. And in Bolden, on April 30th, the union decided to issue a set of more serious demands. They asked for a closed shop, they asked for shorter hours, pay increases, and better overtime. Their demands were rejected again, and 2 weeks later, the local voted to strike. All the while, the new members were continuing to pour in at this time, and by May, they had actually doubled in size. They were up to 6,000 within a month. So one of the first things the local did was to set up a strike committee of about 75 people. And the strike committee created a lot of subcommittees to handle all kinds of different tasks. As I said, it was very well organized. And I need to mention here that of the 75 people on the strike committee, only local president William Brown was a union official. Everyone else was rank and file, basically. So leadership in this strike committee and later throughout really came from below. The local was committed and the pickets were pretty militant. They used some new tactics, at least for that time. They did what we call now flying pickets. They called them cruising pickets. The workers made use of the fact that for probably the first time in history, some of them had cars because, you know, most people, the rich people, had them at the turn of the century, but they were starting to get used cars and things like that. So that really helped. So what they would do is they would cruise the city and they would call in on another call in about every 10, 15 minutes, report what was going on. If they saw that a truck was being loaded to move, they would call in more pickets and ask, you know, say, come on over here and stop this truck. So it was a really effective way of stopping what was going on. And thanks in large part to the experienced activists in and around CLA, this really was one of the most prepared for strikes in history. As the union was going back and forth with the alliance on their demands, they were also busy getting ready. The union set up a strike headquarters in a garage that included easy access for the flying pickets to get in and out, and a well-stocked hospital and food service. I mean, they were not kidding around. They were really serious. Yeah, it was awesome. At this time, of course, there were almost no women working in the industry, but this didn't mean that women were invisible in this strike. In fact, women's wives, girlfriends, mothers, daughters of the strikers wanted to be a part of the action, and they organized themselves into a women's auxiliary. They handled the food and the medical end of things inside the strike headquarters, but then they also came out to picket and they were used in strategic marches and rallies. The strikers also knew that this strike was going to hurt small farmers and grocers, so they didn't want them used against them, and they wanted to build some solidarity. So they reached out to them. Many farmers had also become radicalized in this period, And there, they did a lot of work stoppages that they called farm holidays to demand better prices and government relief for them. So they were not new to this too. The local found ways to help the small farmers get some of their produce directly to small markets, and that really helped them ensure support and a steady flow of food to the strike headquarters. So instead of letting the unemployed be used against them, the local also met with and took up issues with local unemployed workers and really forged a strong relationship of solidarity. The union included demands for the unemployed workers in their own demands, and in return, the unemployed came out to support the strikers and the pickets. So the local also reached out to other unions, which later turned into sympathy strikes and some good solidarity actions. But one of the ones in particular is the taxi cab drivers. They decided to go out and help shut down the city. The building trades too got involved, timing their solidarity strikes to have the biggest impact. And so they struck. By the second day, the entire city of Minneapolis was shut down. Nothing was moved in or out. Unfortunately, this time the Citizens Alliance were a little bit better prepared too. They had set up shop in the Radisson Hotel and they had begun churning out anti-union propaganda and other things. They brought in the police right away, and the police turned around and deputized a slew of these supporters of the alliance, basically thugs, to help control the strikers. So it starts to heat up then. On Saturday, May 19th, the strikers, who were unarmed, were at the marketplace trying to keep the trucks from moving, when they were viciously attacked by the police and the Alliance thugs. In another incident, Alliance members were lured down an alley by someone trying to drive a truckload of newspapers past them. The picketers were then surrounded by thugs waiting in the alley, who savagely beat them. In fact, three women picketers suffered broken legs in that incident. Many were injured and had to be hospitalized. So the next Monday, the strikers were ready for that. Some of them had indeed armed themselves with bats and other things. And about 600 people, strikers went to the Central Labor Union office, which was closer to the market, and they just waited in case something should happen. Another 900 were mobilized at strike headquarters to be ready to come. So at 9 a.m. that day, scabs tried to drive the trucks out, but some picketers were able to block them. The police came out to attack, but they didn't anticipate the 600 or so picketers that were waiting in the hall. The police were routed and about 30 of them were issued, and no trucks moved that day. Mm-hmm. This is a little victory. The next day, people had heard all about this, and about 20,000 people just gathered at the marketplace to either help or just see what was gonna happen. So they didn't have TV, you know. So a minor incident in which the grocer tried to move a few crates of tomatoes on his own is what set it off. This time, the strikers and their supporters were able to beat back about 2,000 police and deputies who had been assembled. In the process, hundreds of cops were injured and two deputies were actually killed. Art Priest, who's the author of a really good book called Labor's Giant Strap, really described this scene vividly. He says, "The pickets charged the deputies first and noticed that many uniformed cops were tending to hang back. Sensing the mood among the cops, the picketers continued to concentrate mainly on the deputies. Finding themselves mousetrapped, many deputies dropped their clubs and ripped off their badges, trying with little success to sort of seek anonymity in the crowd. The scene of the battle spread as cops and deputies alike were driven from the market. The deputies were chased back to their headquarters. The strikers mopped up along the way. Less than an hour after the battle started, there wasn't a cop to be seen in the market, and the picketers were directing traffic." And this became known as the Battle of Deputies Run. So they, some local camera people were there filming, you know, they did newsreels and that they showed in the movie theaters, and they filmed this. And if you go into YouTube and put in Teamsters 1934, you can see some of that, what was going on. So that when that film was shown in theaters, Dobbs noted that many in the audience, working people in the audience, actually were cheering for the strikers as they got their licks in, so it was pretty good. So by this point, things were getting a bit out of hand. So the governor, So the governor Olson decided that, you know, he had a re-election campaign coming in and he had to do something. So he talked to the local labor board and the board offered the strikers a compromise. The union would be recognized and for truck drivers. But as for the other demands, they had to work that out in negotiation with the bosses. So the union took the deal, kind of knowing that the bosses were not going to take it. So, but it wasn't. So the Citizens Alliance decided not to. With the backing of the labor board, the bosses refused to expand union recognition for workers who were not directly related to loading and driving, directly involved. So in the meantime, the head of the Teamsters also got involved, Tobin, who was getting pressure from the AFL bureaucrats to also stop the workers. He decided that the best route for that was to start a red baiting witch hunt, and he went about denouncing the strike leaders as communist thugs. In fact, he published such a nasty anti-communist screed that the Alliance thought this was great, picked it up, and put it in their propaganda. So we'll see where that was going. But I do want to talk a little bit about propaganda and the paper. I need to stop here and say that one of the things that the CLA did directly that really helped the strike was to create a daily paper for the union called The Organizer. It was actually the first daily union paper in the U.S., and it was an excellent organizing tool. The CLA actually helped with national, got involved with some of their national leaders. That's when James P. Cannon came, and he brought along famous editor Max Shackman, who's actually very involved, to help get the paper going, get it out, and to keep their supporters up to date, as well as, you know, keep people informed on the issues. So there was the bosses were not holding up their end of the deal. So on July 16th, the local voted to strike again. For the first few days, the strike was fairly quiet. Picketers were careful not to get sucked into any conflicts with the police. But then on Friday the 20th, because they hadn't done this, they hadn't gotten sucked in, the police were trying to provoke them. And they were trying, the police were trying to escort a scab truck out of the market that day. And they were followed closely by one of the cruising pickets, which basically had a truck full of unarmed strikers. All of a sudden, the police just turned and fired directly into the striker's truck. Two of the strikers were killed, and all hell broke loose. The police fired in all directions, severely injuring 67 people, 13 of whom were just bystanders. Word got out, witnesses saw all of this, and the word got out. So they didn't have the effect they wanted. They didn't intimidate the strikers. That actually solidified their resolve, and 40,000 people turned out for the funeral for one of the men killed. Things had gotten so hot again that Olson threatened to bring in the National Guard. Federal mediators were brought in with an offer that the union could represent all workers in industry, provided it won a pro-strike election. Of course, the employers refused to go along with that, so Olson declared martial law, called in the National Guard, and they quickly, rather than forcing the bosses to do anything, they actually went about helping to bring scab trucks through the city. The union countered that no trucks will move as long as those federal troops were there being used as strike breakers. So on August 1st, this went on for a little while, and then on August 1st, Olson sent in the military force, and they actually took over the strike hall and arrested some of the leaders. Some of the leaders, Dobbs and Grant Dunn, were able to escape, but most of the leading voices in the strike that people knew about had been arrested. But what was so cool about this is this was truly a rank and file strike. And all along, the rank and file was, you know, part of this, and members, there was a whole second, third layer of leadership within, it wasn't just these few guys that people knew their names. So it didn't affect the strike very much at all. So the strike continued as strong as it had ever been, with the second layer of leadership in place. So this was, I would say this is a direct result of the work that the CLA members had done within the union to foster leadership within the rank and file, and to be constantly preparing the next layer of people to take over. So Olson was getting a lot of pressure from Roosevelt because the election was coming up, and he was also getting, of course, pressure from the local to demand release of the strike hall and to release the leaders and get rid of the National Guard. So the governor did back down a bit. He released the hall and the leaders, and then he issued a warning to the bosses demanding that they reach a settlement with the union by August 6th or he would shut down the city. So the union held a mass rally to keep the pressure up on August 6th with about 40,000 people showing up. Negotiations went on at a hotel. They were actually showed up with cars of picketers around their negotiators so that they couldn't be harassed by the police. Police were there. They demanded we weren't going to sit down until you get rid of them. So they were very strong in their negotiations. So both sides kind of hunkered down. The military continued to be used to strike, to break the strike, to let scab trucks through. So there was a constant kind of battle going on between the strikers and at this point the military. So Dobbs kind of calls this period, it was kind of going on a long time, he calls this period the War of Attrition. It was sort of like who's going to give up first. Everybody was tired, the union was running, the local was running out of money. The CLA discussed the situation in their branch, and some people felt like, why don't we go back to work now? We did get, you know, made quite a stand. We won a few things. We're not going to win everything. We can be proud of what we did. But Dobbs, Scoglin, and Ray Dunn argued that the strikers would hold out. And they were the ones who had been working closely with the rank and file. And they said that they will not go back to work. They're tired, but they're not going to back down. So since these comrades had been on the ground with the other rank and file members, it was felt that they knew best. So they weren't going to pull out and they were going to continue to support. So after a standoff of about 2 weeks, the strike just suddenly ended. The bosses actually gave in. Local 574 had won. A key sticking point with the extension of the union recognition to the workers outside the drivers and loaders actually was allowed, and they won this so that workers inside the plant could be part of Local 574, and that was a big victory. And what they really wanted, what they went for, was recognition of their union, and they got it. And that was the big thing that they won, and it was really a big victory. So by this point, let's see. Yeah, so to kind of explain a little bit, Roosevelt had lost patience with Olson. So what he did was he brought in a different mediator who actually took the bosses to task and demanded that they agree to those union recognition elections, and they did. They also promised to hire back the strikers without prejudice. So the employers, the resulting elections after that were a resounding victory for Local 574. So that was the story. Sidney Lenz, in his book, The Labor Wars, points out some very important contributions. I think we should talk maybe more in the discussion about the contributions of a small Trotskyist organization, very small group of people who had a lot of experience in labor. What kind of contributions that they made and how that might inform how we relate to things as labor struggles in the future. So Sidney Lenz pointed out three very important contributions that the CLA made to the strike. First was on the emphasis on the rank and file. Everything was done open. All meetings were open. Everybody was encouraged to get involved and encouraged to take on leadership roles. So basically, like I said before, when they chopped off what they thought was the heads of the strike, it meant nothing because there were so many other people who could step in and fill those shoes. The other part was planning, discipline, organization. They really well planned this and really thought ahead about who are their allies, who might be used against them, how can we reach out even before we do this to make sure that we've got the solidarity that we need and want. And then, of course, the focus and the commitment to their goals. And their key goal, they tried not to get sidetracked by other things, and their key goal was the union recognition, and they kept that eye on their prize, and they didn't let any of the intimidation or any side issues dissuade them. They stuck right with it. This strike, along with the longshoremen strike on the West Coast, the Toledo Auto Light strike, and also less successful but very important textile strike on the East Coast, all of these happened within that period in 1934. And so it was a great and tremendous growth for the labor movement. And this really contributed to the birth of the CIO, later the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and other things that we hear. And I will close with just a little quote from Farrell Dobbs that I thought was nice. He says, "Wiseacres of the day spoke pontificately about the passivity of the working class, never understanding that the seeming docility of the workers at any given time is a relative thing. If workers are more or less holding their own in daily life and expecting that they'll get ahead slowly, they won't tend to radicalize. But things are different when they're losing ground and the future looks precarious to them. Then a change begins to occur in their attitude, which is not always immediately apparent. The tinder of discontent begins to pile up. Any spark can light it, and once lit, the fire can spread rapidly." Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.